Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone, and good evening, everyone. My name is Michal Heller, and I would welcome all of you to the third edition of Tensor Network from Simulations to Holography meeting that is taking place these days virtually and is hosted by PI. And I'm doing this on behalf of the organizational crew, which consists of myself, Carl Janssen, Lena Funke, Stefan Kuhn, Suki Singh, and Volker Sommers, and all of us are here with you today. Before we start, I just want to say that it's kind of great that we can run this meeting despite the pandemic, and we're very happy to see all of you joining in, like first registering and then participating. It's a bit of a, well, I'm like, we're getting used to it, but still it's a bit of an unusual setting for a conference in our field. What I want to emphasize is that we as organizers would like to see this meeting to be, you know, as, you know, interactive as possible. So please do ask questions. If, you know, permitted, please do interrupt and let's make it a big scientific fun. Before we kick in with Mark Carmen, I also want to thank Stephanie Moll, who did a lot of hard work on PI behalf to put this together. And we have also like one more organizational announcement. So the schedule has changed. We're starting with Mark Carmen Banul, and Subir Sachdev's talk is going to be the last talk today. So we basically exchanged the first and the last slot. If there are any other changes, we're going to keep informing you both by email and via Slack. I guess without further ado, we can ask our first speaker to share her screen. Could you please do this, Marie-Carmen?
Yes, I'm doing it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, super. So a quick announcement. With every speaker, we're going to arrange it in principle differently. So Marie-Carmen was kind enough to agree to have questions asked during the talk. So if you're interested to ask a question, please unmute yourself and do it. Of course, if there's going to be too many questions, we're going to try to postpone them till the end so that Marie-Carmen can finish her talk. So let's start. So we are extremely happy to have with us Marie-Carmen Banul from Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics in Göttingen in Germany, who's going to tell us about tensor network for 2+1 dimensional lattice gauge theories. So Marie-Carmen, please take it away.
Thank you very much, Michal, and thank you to all the organizers, of course, for putting together this very nice meeting and for the invitation to talk here, and thank you all for attending this talk. So I want to report on some recent progress on using tensor networks for simulating lattice gauge theories, and in particular, progress going to 2+1 dimensions, so 2 spatial dimensions. This is some recent work that we've been doing in the Institute, in the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics, with Daniel Robaina and Patrick Emons and Ignacio Cirac, and also with Erez Zohar from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So I don't want to give a very extensive introduction, but since the meeting has a broad scope about tensor networks and other connections, I want to focus the attention on the topic of this talk, which is using tensor networks in particular for lattice gauge theories. And there is a good reason for that, for trying this enterprise, because there is a very natural connection somehow between the problems that we can treat with tensor networks and the problems that people doing lattice gauge theories are interested about. So on the one hand, we have tensor networks, which seen as ansatz for states of quantum many-body systems, they give us a non-perturbative way of solving Hamiltonian systems. And we know that they are very, very successful for one-dimensional systems. Basically, the paradigmatic tensor network is the matrix product state, which is at the basis of the success of the DMRG algorithm. And we know how to do things in higher dimensions. The progress has been very fast in the last years. And with all these tools, we can compute ground states, we can compute low energy excitations, we can also do thermal states. All these things are very accurate and very efficient. And we also know how to do some time evolution with some caveats, some restrictions, but we can do things in real-time dynamics. On the other hand, we have lattice gate theories, which originally were introduced as a way of solving non-perturbatively quantum field theory, in particular for QCD. And this technique has been developed a lot during decades, and it's very powerful, and usually mainly uses path integral formalism and Monte Carlo techniques. With this, the results achieved by say, lattice QCD have been very impressive. They can deal with a four-dimensional lattice in 3+1 dimensions and compute spectral properties, so equilibrium properties at finite temperature too. And as I said, the lattices are very big in dimension and also very big in size. But there are problems where these techniques do not work. And in particular, due to the sign problem in Monte Carlo techniques, one cannot do, except for some exceptions, cases where there is a chemical potential or a finite density of particles, and also real-time evolution. So since there is this niche of problems which are interesting, and tensor networks in principle can give us a handle on, it makes sense to put these two things together and explore the applications of tensor networks to these kind of problems. Of course, there are different ways to go about that. So on the one hand, there is a more formal approach, and on the other hand, there is the possibility of doing numerical simulations. So more formally, there is a question of how tensor networks can incorporate the gauge symmetry themselves. And this has been studied by different people already in the last years, and they have been able to construct states that are explicitly invariant under the desired symmetry. There are explicit constructions and general prescriptions, and this is a fruitful line of research that is going on. On the other hand, there is the possibility of doing numerical simulations, and one big selling point of this is that there is no sign problem in tensor networks calculations. So there are, again, different ways of doing these simulations, and one of them is more, so it's closer to the way of lattice QCD, because then a tensor network can be used to describe a partition function or observables. And then there are different approaches to compute the value of this partition function or to approximate it when it is expressed as tensors and manipulated with tensor methods. And these approaches are typically called tensor normalization group approaches, and they have been used or applied for classical and quantum gauge models. There's been a number of works in the recent years, and there is a recent review paper in the archive that summarizes some of these efforts. This is not, however, what I'm talking about in this talk. So I'm talking about another possibility to do numerical simulations, which is using the tensor networks to describe states. So as I said before, as an ansatz for the quantum many-body state. And if we want to do this, there are some kind of general ideas that we need to consider. So on the one hand, we work with a Hamiltonian formulation. So we have to define a Hamiltonian which is acting on a Hilbert space. And we need to choose a proper basis where our state is written or can be written as a tensor network. So mostly, the tensor networks deal with finite dimensional degrees of freedom. So in a gauge theory, typically we have fermionic and gauge degrees of freedom. And the fermions are okay in the sense of finite dimensions. As I said before, the tensor network methods do not suffer from a sign problem. So in this sense, they are more natural to be included in this formalism. On the other hand, we have also gauge bosons. And this might require a special tension because they are not finite dimensional. They have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But there are different ways to deal with them also in this context. So one of them is clearly truncating the possible occupation of the gauge bosons. Or in small dimensions, one can also integrate them out. But there are also gauge theories, which are from constructions or from the beginning, finite dimensional. So the gauge degrees of freedom are also finite dimensional. It's the case, for instance, of the quantum link models. and that are also interesting on their own to be studied, and they can be represented again as tensor networks or studied with tensor networks. Let me just mention here that although I'm not talking about this, these ingredients are also common for the problem of proposing a quantum simulation of a lattice gauge theory. And there's been a lot of proposals in this direction for different models and using different platforms and so on. I just want to mention this possibility here, although this is, I said, not what I'm talking about today. There are also other topics related to these problems that I'm not talking about, but I just want to mention. One of them is that these tensor networks can be used for other quantum field theories, not only lattice gauge theories. And there will be at least some of these issues discussed in Christoph Sihi's talk on Thursday. And also, it is possible to deal not with a lattice problem, but also study tensor networks directly in a continuum formulation and how this works for quantum field theories. So this is, again, a very interesting related topic, but not what I'm talking about now. So what I want to talk about is this enterprise that I mentioned before, where we want to use tensor networks for the same kind of problems that lattice QCD is doing. So of course, there is a very long way to go until being able to do tensor network calculations for lattice QCD, but one has to start somewhere to test if this is really a way that we can go. And the journey starts with a one-dimensional test, or many one-dimensional tests. So there were already early works with DMRG for some lattice gauge theories, in particular for the Schwinger model, and then for other field theories, even before the generalization of the tensor network language. And after the tensor network picture came about, there were also some early works by Luca Tajacozzo and Geoffrey Vidal, and sometime later in the TRG formalist by Yannick Maurice and co-workers, about putting together these tensor network formalisms and the gauge symmetric problems. But it was more recently, I would say, when sort of a more systematic program appeared of trying to explore really this way that I'm picturing here. And the first phase of that was really exploring like the most basic test bench for these issues, which is the Schwinger model, basically QED in one spatial dimension. And different groups have been working on this for the last 7 or 8 years. And it's been possible to prove that it is possible to do very precise equilibrium simulations and also to propose and even realize some early quantum simulations of the problem. Of course, this is a first step, and one has to increase the complication of the problem by including elements that are complicated for the Monte Carlo standard techniques. And one of them is including a finite density or a chemical potential. And this has also been done, for instance, in the Schwinger model by Stefan. And also to go to more complicated models that include, for instance, a non-abelian gauge symmetry. Different groups, again, have been working on this, and there have been a number of very interesting results. This is all in one dimension. So the progress in higher dimensions has been not yet so big, but there have already been some advances. The first work I mentioned in here is using three tensor networks, and I believe that Simone might report about this and some more advanced simulations on Friday. And what I want to tell you about today is simulations with PEPs we have been developing more recently. If you are interested in more details about this road, I can recommend you to look at these two recent reviews that include also the advances regarding quantum simulation. So, to summarize these results, what's been tested already very thoroughly is the feasibility of tensor networks to study lattice gauge theories in one spatial dimension. And this has been proven by achieving very high numerical precision, better than other methods in particular problems, and computing spectral thermal properties, computing cases with chemical potential, and some real-time dynamics, and also a billion and non-abelian models. But of course, the next step, what we want to do is to go to higher dimensions, to continue probing the feasibility of these answers. So going to more than one dimension, there have already been, as I said, some results with other tensor networks, but I want to talk about PEPs. And as I said before, it is possible to construct PEPs which are explicitly gauge invariant. So already with these early proposals, people did some restricted calculations with them, but no full variational optimization yet. It is also possible to restrict the PEP ansatz itself, and this is one of the things I would like to tell you about a bit later in the talk, to make these calculations a bit more efficient. But generally speaking, one can look at the tensor network toolbox and say that it already has the ingredients that one needs to do PEPs calculations for a lattice gauge theory. But the reason why they are not so commonly done as for one-dimensional problems is, on the one hand, that they are much more costly computationally, and then the one dimension one can reach is relatively small. So it might be that for some problems, one needs a one dimension that is larger than what one has done so far or has been able to do so far. And one particular problem of lattice gauge theories, because this computational cost is, of course, true also for condensed matter problems. But lattice gauge theories also have an additional problem, which is the presence of plaquette terms, which are less local than other terms in common Hamiltonians we deal with. So regarding the computational cost, although this is something that makes the simulations more costly, there's been a very very impressive progress in the algorithms in the last few years, and there have been results where the PEPs calculations have already outperformed other methods in some particular condensed matter problems. So the perspective in there is good, although these algorithms are still more complicated than the ones in one dimension. Regarding the plaquette terms, it's also been tried to say optimize two tensors, so four tensors say at once. So a plaquette term typically looks like this in a lattice gauge theory, affecting all sides around a certain plaquette at the same time. So if one wants to update all tensors affected by one of these plaquette terms at once, it's four terms, compared to typically nearest neighbor Hamiltonians that appear in many other problems. So this has been done numerically, but it imposes a much larger cost, and this translates into being able to deal with only more limited one dimension. So what I want to tell you about here is a new strategy that allows to deal with these terms in a more efficient way, and thus allows to do this simulation of lattice gauge theories with PEPs in a more efficient way. So the idea of this strategy is to generalize another strategy which was proposed a few years ago by Eres Zohar and co-workers in a series of papers to deal mainly with precisely the quantum simulation of this kind of theories in a digital manner, so with a digital quantum simulation. So the basic idea is that in this proposal, the plaquette terms, which typically affect, say, four gauge degrees of freedom around the plaquette, reduce to a sequence of nearest neighbor interactions. And the cost is that one has to introduce ancillary degrees of freedom. What one can realize is that this trick also helps imposing Gauss law, and one can incorporate it in an imaginary time evolution with infinite PEPs. And this is basically what we have used to study the phase diagram of a lattice gauge theory, in this case, a pure gauge Z3. So the model we study here is the following. So we consider a square lattice, and the degrees of freedom reside on the links. So these blue dots. Because this is a three, each of the dimensions, the physical dimension of each of the of these degrees of freedom is three. We choose a basis, say an electric basis, where this field takes values minus one, zero, and one. And the Hamiltonian has two terms, one which is the electric term, basically, which is local, and then a Plaquette term. And the Plaquette term, as I showed before, involves the degrees of freedom around a Plaquette, so four of them. And okay, these U operators here, in this case, act as cyclic raising or lowering operators of the electric field. So this model is known to have a phase transition between a deconfined and a confined phases as we change the coupling G squared. And another reason why these models are interested is that one can treat Zn models in general, and as n goes to infinity, this converges to the U1 symmetry. And in this case, the electric and so the E and Plaquette term really correspond to the electric and magnetic terms in the energy. So the symmetry in this model is the following. So it's a Z3 symmetry. So the Hamiltonian commutes with a symmetry transformation corresponding to each vertex. And this symmetry operators is which we are calling here G. So in here, they basically correspond to the Z3 version of Gauss' law, basically. So what physical states satisfy is that they have a well-defined value of this G operator, which, as you see, is basically the sum of, say, incoming and outgoing electric fields in a given vertex. This has to be equal to a value which doesn't need to be zero. This is basically an external charge, a static charge. And it can take, again, values in Z3, minus one, zero, or one. So let me show how, in the particular case of this model, one can put in practice what I was saying before. So the strategy that I was mentioning before for quantum digital simulation, so to implement the Plaquette terms, is the following. So one wants to apply a certain term, a certain operator, H, could be the Hamiltonian, but can be something else, to some degrees of freedom. And instead of doing it in that way, one applies the following trick. So we introduce an ancillary system, which is at a given initial state. And then we apply a unitary to both the system and the ancilla. And what we want is to find such an initial state for the ancilla and such a unitary, such that we can actually apply the operator by acting not on the system, but on the ancilla. So there is another operator which we can apply on the ancilla after having connected it to the system with this unitary. And this object that appears here, that includes the ancilla in a given state and applies a unitary to both the system and the ancilla, this is really an isometry that maps the system degree of freedom to something bigger. This is called a stator, and it was introduced by Eresoar and co-workers in these papers. And mathematically, there is an identity here that tells us that for this particular operator, the action of the operator followed by this S is the same thing as first applying the S and then acting with the operator. If this is fulfilled, then of course we can invert the unitary and do the unitary, pass it to the other side. And then what we see is that by applying first this unitary, then acting on the ancilla, and then undoing the unitary, we have obtained exactly the same result as acting originally on the operator, on the system degrees of freedom, and having done nothing to the state of the ancilla. So this is, of course, an entangling step, connecting the system and the ancilla, and then a disentangling step. So in our case, we want to do this for the Plaquette terms in the Hamiltonian. So the system really is the four links involved in a plaquette term. And so the way this works is the following. We need to specify an ancillary degree of freedom with an initial state, and then a unitary that acts on all of them. So the ancillary degree of degree of freedom is introduced in the center of the plaquette, and it has the same, it's just a copy of the Hilbert space of one of the links. And it's initialized in an equal superposition of all the three states. And then the entangling between this ancilla and the links can be done by a sequence of entangling operations, which basically entangle each of the links with the ancilla by a, it's basically a controlled operation, which depending on the state of the ancilla, this is basically a projector, say on state one, then it applies some operator on the link. And by this sequence of operators, so acting on the three links involved in the ancilla, what one obtains, and this can be checked, is that the result of applying the plaquette term on, say, the four links at the same time is the same as applying a raising or lowering operator on the ancilla after this entangling step. And something similar happens for Gauss law. So if we want to impose Gauss law by projecting the value of the electric field around a certain vertex with so corresponding to some value of the external charge, we can write this projector as the sum of terms. So each of these terms is basically a product of local projectors onto the four links involved, and then we have a sum of the three of them. So it's again a non-local thing. We can again find an isometry, as I was defining before, by including an ancillary degree of freedom and a unitary that allows us to do this locally on a, on this extra degree of freedom. So in this case, the ancilla is included in the vertex, and it's again a copy of the same Hilbert space that, that we needed for one of the link degrees of freedom. And the entangling operation can again be constructed as this sequence of entangling operations with each of the links involved, which in this case look like this. I don't want to stop very much in the particular form, but just a general idea. So we are entangling again with a controlled operation, which projects on the ancilla state, and depending on that, applies some kind of unitary to the links involved. And then it is possible to see that that okay, this this stator fulfills the property that we wanted with respect to the projector if the local operator that we apply later on the vertex degree of freedom is what I'm showing in here. But it, this has a different form than before, but it is still a local operator that acts on the vertex. And now we can use all these ingredients into the IPEP simulation. So very generally speaking, the IPEP simulation is done with imaginary time evolution, which means that we start with some initial state, in our case, a simple initial state, which can be written as a PEPS. And we apply a real exponential of the Hamiltonian, which basically projects onto the ground state effectively. And the way we apply this exponential is using a Trotter decomposition such that the whole imaginary time evolution is split into small steps. And in each of these steps, we approximate the effect by applying evolutions with each of the terms in the Hamiltonian. So on the one hand, we have the electric term, which is local, as I was showing before. So this one is really not a problem. It doesn't introduce any extra bond dimension in our PEPS. And then there is the plaquette term, which is the more costly one, but we can use it, apply it, using this construction that I just described with the ancillas. So in our case, we use simple update to evolve the tensors and the contraction to compute the energies or the expectation values. We need a more accurate estimation of the contraction. And this is done with the corner transfer matrix. And we use the Psi-10 toolkit that was developed by Claudius Hubig. to do these simulations. So in the IPEPS simulation, so the I stands for infinite PEPS. So the PEPS is really like a repetition of a unit cell over an infinitely large lattice. And the unit cell that we use has 16 tensors, it's 4 times 4, and it's chosen as I'm showing here. So on the one hand, we have the link degrees of freedom, the gauge degrees of freedom, which have physical dimension 3, as I said before. And then we have to introduce ancillary degrees of freedom for the Blackett terms, which also have one dimension 3, and they live in the center of the Blackett. And finally, we also have vertex ancillary degrees of freedom, which are used to ensure Gauss law. So this is the tensors that compose our unit cell. So 16 tensors, which in principle can all be different in the simulation. So the simulation chooses the variational parameters to optimize the calculation. So to, in our case, decrease the energy by this imaginary time evolution. And we use the construction that I just defined or described to impose the charge sector we want at the beginning of the simulation with the vertex projector. So let me show you the results that we obtain with this method. So I already said that the method is known to have a first order, it's a phase transition, is known to be first order. And we can explore this by looking at the energy of the ground state. So in this plot, I'm showing for the case where there are no external charges. So this is just to remind you of where the links degrees of freedom are. And in the vertex, I'm not putting anything, meaning that there's no external charge. So in this case, if we plot the energy, actually rescaled by the coupling constant, as a function of the coupling constant, again, the very small coupling constant corresponds to the deconfined regime, and very large coupling constant corresponds to the confined regime, we observe that there is a cusp in the energy. So we can look at this in more detail, so zoom in, and using here results for D equal 4 and D equal 5, they are basically quite converged. If we look closely, you see that close to the transition, we have some points that are not really fully converged. We think that this is also related to the fact that we are using the simple update. But we can estimate where the first order phase transition lies, because we have this clearly identified two branches that cross somewhere around 1.1 for this G square. We can do the same thing by putting external charges. So this would be putting these static charges in two of the vertices of our unit cell. And of course, when the value of the coupling constant increases, it gets very, very large. The electric term dominates the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is something like G square E square plus or minus 1 divided G square, the Blackett term. So magnetic term. So when G is very large, the electric term dominates, and to minimize the energy, the system wants to put the electric field to zero everywhere. But if there are external charges, it cannot do it everywhere because it still has to preserve Gauss law. So there is some electric field in here, and this increases the energy. So the energy actually increases as G squared. And here we are plotting for the sake of the seeing everything in the same plot, G square times the energy per plaquette. So we see that after the phase transition, there is a difference in between having external charges or not because of this reason. So one way to realize or check that this is in fact a first order phase transition is looking at the derivative of the energy. So we see this cusp in the no external charge situation, but we can actually look at the derivative of the energy and see that there is in fact a jump in the derivative that corresponds to this or agrees with this phase transition. So another way of exploring this or distinguishing this confined from deconfined regime is to look at the Wilson loop. So in the confined regime, we expect that the value of the Wilson loop decays with the area. So the Wilson loop is an operator, which is gauge invariant, corresponds to a product of U operators. So the one that is shown here corresponds to the same as the Blackett, but one can construct these loops in different shapes or sizes. And what I said before is that in the confined regime, we expect that expectation value decays with the area. The coefficient in front is the string tension. So this is something that we can compute in our ground state. And for reasons of the computational cost, we restrict our calculation to Wilson loops, which have dimension 1 times n, so they are really longer and longer, but we do not increase the height because this increases a lot the computation. And if we want to do the calculations with our largest one dimensions, we cut our costs in this way. But then we can explore different sizes and see how the value depends on the area. So try to see if it corresponds to this exponential law. And this is what the plot shows. So in the plot, you can see the value, actually the logarithm of the expectation value as a function of the length of the loop. As I said, in this case, the area is just proportional to the length because it's in 1 times n, so it's basically the same. So you can see that for small values of the coupling, which in here correspond to these bluish colors, there is no decay that is apparent. But as the coupling begins to increase and gets closer to the transition that we identified before, we see this decay. And in here, for large G-square, so for large coupling, you see very clearly how well this area law is fulfilled. So we can actually look at the coefficients of this, so at the slopes of these fields, which are these exponents, so these coefficients in the exponent, and plot it as a function of the coupling. And this gives us a more accurate estimate of where the transition happens. And the yellow points or the orange points in here show precisely these coefficients, and you can see how they decrease very abruptly towards the critical value that we were seeing before. And we can actually fit these values to this form that I'm showing it here, and figure out what the critical value of the coupling is. And this gives us a value, an estimate of the value, which is 1.16. So finally, there is another way to visualize the features of the confinement in this model, which is very, very visual, say, in our calculations, which is looking at the map of electric field in the ground state. So we can compare the situation without charges on the left and with external charges on the right. So in the case where the coupling is very small, so the deconfined regime, basically this just plots in a color plot the value of the electric field in each of the links that correspond to the blue dots in there, and they are all the same as you find in our unit cell. This is our unit cell. And actually, they have an expectation value of around 0.5. If we do the same thing for external charges, there is basically no difference. It's very similar. So this is in the regime, which is magnetically dominated with a small coupling constant. Now we can go to the other regime with a very strong coupling constant. In that case, as I said before, the system wants to minimize the energy by reducing the electric field in the links. And we find that in the case with no external charges, there's zero electric field everywhere. Basically, we don't see anything here. But if we have external charges and do the same thing, then because of Gauss' law, not all the electric field can be zero. And what the system chooses to do is to confine this electric field to a single link between the charges. So to summarize these calculations, what we have done in here is to generalize a strategy that allows to include these placket terms in the most up-to-date, basically, IPEPS algorithms, and then gives us access to larger bond dimensions in these simulations and has allowed us to do basically a fully variational study of a lattice gate theory using PEPS. And we have found that actually a very moderate bond dimension is enough to capture all phases in this model. Of course, this strategy can also be applied to other cases, and this is something to be done, like including dynamical fermions in the same picture, or going to other more complicated theories. So I I would like to spend still like a few minutes talking about something else, but I don't know if there are any questions now. I can also take some questions now.
Yes, please go ahead, David.
Yeah, well, if we're taking questions now, I thought I might raise the issue that these 1/n elongated Wilson loops make the area law the same as the perimeter law. So yes. Obviously you're assuming that this is an area law kicking in.
Yes.
I don't know if this is, if you have any, you're nodding your head, so you've thought about this and might have some comments prepared.
Yes, no, yeah. So we actually explored also the perimeter law, and you can see that everything is compatible with a perimeter law all the way around, but it's not compatible with an area law all the way. So we really see this like shooting up of the coefficient. So of course, as you said, to really have a more accurate distinction of both laws, we would like to have other sizes. But this turned out to be too costly to do something numerically so accurate as we had. But we are confident on our results because there is really very good. So there's really a very clear difference on how the data fit this area law decay in one regime and the other. So you have a string tension which is basically zero in the left part. Although as you said, there could be some shift, right? Because there could be a perimeter law kicking in there, but you still see the difference of the behavior.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
In the previous graph, when you showed the G squared, the coupling, could you just describe what that would be?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You want to see to know what G squared is?
More like a definition, because you said in the last graph you showed us, you had G squared and then you came up with a critical value.
Yes.
So what does that translate theory? Like what is the G squared value?
Okay, G squared is here. You see, it's the coupling constant in the Hamiltonian that weights the electric and the magnetic terms.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. So, okay. So let me just in the last few minutes to present you another approach, which also allows us to do these higher dimensional simulations. So as I said before, from the formal approach, it is possible to write explicitly gauge invariant PEPs, and this has been done for different models. And some numerical calculations have been done, but mostly limited to either very, very small number of variational parameters, or exploring which kind of phases these kind of states could do. And one big reason for that is the computational cost of anything that has to do with PEPs. So one possibility to go around that is to consider restricted families of PEPs. I already said something before about restricted families of tensor networks like trees or meras that allow for some better efficiency in the contractions, and they can be useful for some problems. So PEPs are more general, but they are computationally more costly. And then considering subfamilies of PEPs that allow for efficient contraction makes all sense, because maybe they are enough to describe interesting phases. And actually, a couple of years ago, Eres Zohar and Ignacio Cirac proposed a way in which one could do efficient calculations with a family of PEPs using Monte Carlo techniques. So combining PEPs and Monte Carlo in this case, it is possible to compute things more efficiently. And actually, together with also Patrick Emmons, we have shown that this is actually, in this same model, accurate enough for certain regimes. So explore much more the variational power of this possibility. So the essential idea in here, I just want to be quite fast because I don't have so much more time. But the essential idea is constructing a PEPs which is gauge invariant. And for PEPs, it is well understood how to combine PEPs with symmetries. So one can construct a state which is globally invariant, so invariant under a global symmetry, if the tensors are invariant, which means they have well-defined transformation laws. So in this case, in this picture, this block here is a BEPS tensor, and this circle is corresponds to a local unitary transformation that corresponds to a group element for some group. And by saying that the tensor has well-defined transformation properties, what I mean is that when you act on the physical degree of freedom, which would be the vertical one in here with this transformation, virtual degrees of freedom transform in a well-defined way that corresponds to representations of the group. So it's easy to see, actually, that if you have tensors that fulfill this property and an infinite PEPS, which is let's say that the unit cell is just one tensor, this state is globally invariant, because if we act with this global unitary all over the place, so in all the sites in our network, then using this transformation law, we can see that these transformations cancel and the state is globally invariant. Now, if one wants to gauge the PEPS, that means making the symmetry local, so achieving an invariance under just a local transformation, which would act in this way with an invariant tensor. The solution, which was developed in several works some 5 years ago, goes through including extra degrees of freedom. It's very similar to a minimal coupling approach, but acting directly on the state. And these extra degrees of freedom, which are the gauge degrees of freedom that live on the link. So I didn't say it before, but in this case, we interpret the vertices as the matter. So the way the problem is described is very similar to this minimal coupling problem. One can start with matter, which could be non-interacting, and then gauge the state by including these extra degrees of freedom. Okay, these extra tensors have also well-defined transformation properties, which correspond in this case to the gauge. Symmetry. And if this is the case, now one can see that acting with a local gauge transformation, which affects a vertex and the links attached to it. And well, I didn't stop to explain it, but this can be done for abelian and non-abelian symmetries. If the transformation properties hold, so all the tensors transform properly under the gauge transformation, well, this can also be ensured to keep the state invariant. So now we have a whole state, which is of matter, which lives on the vertices, and a gauge degrees of freedom. And the whole state can be written, so by choosing a basis for the gauge degrees of freedom, one can always write this as a sum of gauge configurations, tensor, some matter configurations. It's an entangled state, matter and gauge. And in this expression here, this matter part is a state which is not normalized. I'm not including coefficients. So in this kind of state, if one wants to compute observables, let's consider an observable which is diagonal in gauge variables, so it only depends on the value of the gauge variables, then the value of the observable can be written simply in this way that I'm showing here, by just applying an observable which only depends on the gauge, and then dividing by the norm of the state. Oh, sorry, here there's a bra sign missing. So this quantity in here, this is just the norm of a state, and it's a positive definite quantity. It can be seen as a probability distribution, and then if this can be computed, one can use Monte Carlo sampling to estimate the value of this operator. And the thing is that this quantity can be computed efficiently for some specific constructions of the state. And this is actually the case of gauge Gaussian PEPS. So the idea is to start with fermionic matter, which is non-interacting and is described by a Gaussian fermionic PEPS, which is globally symmetric, as I was showing before in the picture. So it's symmetric under the global transformation. And then to introduce additional gauge degrees of freedom in a proper way, which are connected to the virtual degrees of freedom in a way chosen such that the gauge symmetry is fulfilled. And then one ends up in an expression like I had before, where the matter part of the state is just a fermionic Gaussian fermionic Gaussian PEPS. And then this contraction can be done efficiently, because one can use all the Gaussian formalism where everything can be computed in terms of covariance matrices and not, it's not exponentially costly in the size of the system. So it's important to notice that the whole state is not Gaussian, so it can describe interactions between gauge and fermionic degrees of freedom. And this was described in more detail in the papers that I was mentioning before by Eres and Ignacio. And what Patrick did more recently, Patrick Hemons, and also together with Ignacio and Eres, was to apply this numerically to precisely the same gauge, lattice gauge theory that I was talking about before. So it's again a pure gauge theory, and the answers can be made to incorporate translational and rotational symmetries, and it works for finite lattices with periodic boundary conditions. So the number of variational parameters can be controlled by this Gaussian construction. I don't have time to go into the details. And then variational Monte Carlo can be used to optimize the parameters. And Monte Carlo sampling to compute the expectation values, of course. And the results can be, for small systems, can be compared to exact diagonalization results. So in here, for instance, there are the results compared to exactly a 2x2 lattice, periodic in both directions. And the number of parameters is here encoded in the number of layers. And one can see that for some regime, this works extremely well already for very, very few parameters. So actually one layer corresponds to two variational parameters only. And in the magnetically dominated regime, one needs more layers to get a good description. And the worst happens close to the phase transition. And this can be studied also for larger lattices, and sort of the conclusion is what I already said, that probably this is not enough close to the transition, but it works very well in a very large regime of couplings. So I'm already at the end, so I just want to summarize what I said, that we know now that tensor networks work very well for one-dimensional lattice gauge theories. And this has been tested in many, many studies. And for high dimensions, we are seeing now results, and I wanted to report on some progress in using PEPs for 2+1 dimensional lattice gauge theories. We have the first fully variational study of a Z3 theory, and also some finite PEPs simulations with the combination of variational Monte Carlo and Gaussian fermionic PEPs. And all these steps, I think, bring us closer to being able to attack more complicated problems, hopefully, with these tensor network techniques. And yeah, this is all I wanted to tell you. Thank you very much for your attention. And I'll be happy to answer if you have any more questions.
Thank you, Mary Carmen, for the talk. We do have some time for questions, so please go ahead and unmute yourself if you have any.
Okay, maybe I can ask one question. Can you hear me?
Hi, Mary Carmen.
Thanks for the talk. So so these gauge theories that you discussed, Z3 is a special example of a more general class of these string net models. I couldn't quite see this trick of this Anschler implementation. Does it also work for such extensions or?
Okay, I don't know. I haven't thought about this. It works for more general gauge groups, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay. But then you can go beyond gauge groups, traditional gauge groups, right? And this more general.
Yeah, in principle, it can work. You have to find the proper operators, I think. But
this Levin-Wen models, I guess, is an extension mm-hmm. of the gauge theory, right? That I was just wondering to which extent the implementation that you have now describes
yeah.
it works
okay.
also in this context.
Okay, so the trick is not restricted to gauge theories or gauge symmetric operators at all. So it's a way of implementing, say, non-local terms thanks to these ancillary degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. So it's much more general,
sure.
It might be that the operators themselves look different depending on what you want to implement, of course. Mm-hmm.
And then maybe one quick question on computational costs. If you go to other groups like Zn or some simple non-abelian groups, yes. How does that?
Yes, that immediately increases the physical dimension of all our degrees of freedom, and then of course the question is how big is the bond dimension you need to get comparably converged states. Of course, we cannot say beforehand. We have seen that in our case, the convergence is pretty good, almost all over the place. So I would expect that probably when you get closer to the transition, you see something. Also, there is another issue that the phase transition might be of different order, right? It's first order for Z3. But if it is not first order for larger n, which is it isn't, then I would expect that the state gets more and more difficult to describe closer to the phase transition. How close to that you need to go to see some reasonable results, this I cannot tell you. But that would certainly mean that you need at least to try large bond dimensions.
Thanks.
Do you have any more questions? If not, let me just make a, well, I mean, let me thank Mary Carmen for this talk.